This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
Although crime rates in Canada are at their lowest point since 1972, the Conservative government has persisted with a tough-on-crime agenda. Last spring, they passed the Safe Streets and Communities Act, more commonly known as the Omnibus Crime Bill, a piece of legislation that was widely criticized for its punitive approach and unproven methods for increasing public safety. Now, a new report by Pivot Legal Society concludes that several provisions of the Act, including mandatory minimum sentences for certain drug offenses, are unlikely to achieve their stated goals of deterrence for offenders and the disruption of organized crime. It concluded that the bill may violate the charter rights of some highly marginalized people who are likely to be adversely affected by its application. Scott Bernstein is a lawyer with Pivot Legal, co-author of the report, and he's joined me in the studio. Welcome, Scott, and you know, it's really nice to have somebody come down to the studio, so I appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
There was a lot of opposition to the Omnibus Crime Bill when it was proposed, and yet the federal government, as seems to be its wont, passed it into law. Why this report that you've done now, a year and some after the Omnibus Bill was passed?
Well, when this legislation was being debated, and then of course after it was passed in March of 2012, we were concerned about the impact of this legislation on people in this community, and particularly marginalized drug users, who we thought we had a sense, just based on what we knew about things, that they would be caught up in the net of this crime bill. And so we, you know, a lot of the language that the federal government was using was, you know, this is going after the big drug kingpins and organized crime, and we saw it more as targeting people on the streets. And so what we did is we went back to what we usually do, and we talked to people in this community and find out how this is really affecting them. And so we started out with interviews. So we ended up doing 19 life story interviews. So those are where we talk with people quite informally, but along a certain direction of getting information out, and just very open-ended questions to hear their stories. And so we did 19 of these life story interviews with people who use drugs in Vancouver and Victoria. And then we took that information, the stories, and we incorporated them into this report, along with some analysis of looking at the different literature and social science that talks about mandatory minimums, and particularly experiences with mandatory minimums in the United States, because, you know, we're not in a bubble here. We can look south and see what's been done with the experiment on mandatory minimum sentences and tough on crime legislation against drug users in the States, and the effects of that, and kind of predict, well, you know, these are kinds of things we might see here as well. So we looked at the social science, we looked at the life story interviews, and then the final piece of it was looking at trying to analyze, well, what does this mean in a Canadian human rights context? And so what does it mean with respect to human rights codes and the Charter of Rights and Freedoms? And so the end result was, you know, we found that this legislation is going to be pretty difficult on marginalized drug users and is going to raise some charter concerns.
How do you, have you, I guess, had any critique of the way you selected people to interview here, and how that fits in with what you want to find, so that the question of reliability of information is easily explained and...
Right. So it wasn't really intended to be a, you know, a rigorous research study to say, you know, 30% of people experience this or that. It was mostly a self-selected group. We put out the word through posters and word of mouth to different areas that people who use drugs congregate. And so in Vancouver, we worked primarily with people through life skills center where we're the drug user group, and we connected with other drug user organizations in Victoria. So it wasn't really meant to be a scientific survey of everything, but it was more about the context. And we just wanted to talk with people who had experience of incarceration, who had experience of criminal justice, who had experience in youth justice system, and hear just how it affected them to give more. We wanted to give a bit of more context of this is how it's going to affect people on the ground, and these are some of the issues that will be raised. But, we didn't want to just come at this from a social science point of view and say, you know, this is what the academics say. We wanted to have more of a voice of the people we think were going to be most affected by that in that, and that's reflected in the report.
So the rationale that the government gives for mandatory minimum sentences is that it's going to fight organized crime, as you said, and be a deterrent for further criminal activity. But what did your research tell you about the deterrent effect of heavy sentences on people who are struggling already with addictions?
Yeah. So again, the key point is, you know, a lot of people caught up in this legislation. So we're particularly the legislation enacted some different changes to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, the Youth Criminal Justice Act, and some other sentencing or some other post-sentencing. So, for example, your records and parole changes as well. So we were concerned kind of this big picture of it. The thing that we think is probably going to most affect marginalized drug users is the mandatory minimum sentences for possession of drugs for the purpose of trafficking in conjunction with some aggravating factors that have to be met. But a lot of those aggravating factors are you've been charged with something in the past. So a lot of times people who are dependent on drugs may end up having a little bit of drugs that they sell to finance their own addiction. And so they'll be caught up in this legislation for that. And so what we found talking with people and also looking, bouncing that off of the social science literature that's out there, was that deterrence, the promise of a tough sentence doesn't really play out for this particular community. That's not that most of the people engaging in this behavior aren't what they call calculators who look and say, oh, you know, if I do this, I'm going to end up with this. It's more just living in the moment and survival types of behavior. And so what they've seen in the States, and we can look to the literature there, is that it really hasn't had a deterrent effect on drug crime. And what it has done, though, in the States is it's filled the prisons with small-time drug users who are caught up in this net. And so it's really interesting. You know, we look at the experiment of the States, and we're a bit behind the curve now because in the U.S. they're unraveling a lot of this tough-on-crime legislation and the punitive measures, and we're now going the opposite direction. And so it's strange when you have attorneys general and law enforcement people in the States counseling the Harper government, you know, saying, don't do this, don't do what we did, please don't do what we did, you know, and that's kind of an opposite of the narrative that we usually like to portray the States. You know, we like to say, well, Canada's being very progressive and open, and the States is being hardline conservative. Well, in this particular situation, it's the opposite.
So what have you learned about the adverse effects of putting more people in prison, of incarceration of people who are addicted already to drugs?
Yeah. So incarceration is, you know, it's a very blunt force instrument that is quite expensive. So I'll start from just a very economic based argument, and it doesn't make sense. Your money is much better spent in working with people who use drugs. If your real goal is, you know, we want to reduce drug use or drug crime or something like that, or reduce addiction, you know, get people into treatment, you're better off investing your money in other types of social services that don't penalize people and have a rational approach. But, you know, instead it's quite expensive to incarcerate people. So the effect of incarcerating people who use drugs, though, is that their addictions actually become worse, because prisons are not a place that are drug-free. In fact, drugs are available. Oftentimes, security guards who have all sorts of motivations are the ones bringing in drugs and selling them to people. And so what is absent in prison, however, are harm reduction measures. So you have an addiction, you have an access to drugs in prison, and despite all of the despite all of the effort and all of the pressure put on keeping drugs out of prison, there's nothing that really has been shown to be effective in doing that. So despite focused intention of the government to keep prisons drug free, it's just not a reality that's going to happen. And so you have people in prison who are using drugs, and the only needles they can use are shared needles. And so you're having people who are now injecting drugs and transmitting HIV, transmitting hepatitis C, and not having access. And so it's a real public health problem. And then when people are released from prison, that is one of the times that they're most vulnerable to overdose and death. And so we see people routinely who get released from prison and are involved in using drugs again on the street and end up overdosing. And so it's quite harmful. And the fact is, prison doesn't lead to more treatment. It doesn't lead to a better outcome. What it does lead is to further stigmatization and institutionalization of people that removes them from society, removes them from the social supports that actually can help them.
Does longer and more frequent incarceration affect? I'm sure it does, but in what ways people's ability to reintegrate to the society?
Yeah, so it's pretty well documented, and so it's documented both in the stories of the people we talk to and also in the literature that, this idea of institutionalization is really a real thing. And so we have to realize that someday, particularly we're locking somebody up for drug crimes, we're not locking them up the entire term of their life. It's some years, and those people are going to be coming out someday. And so as a society, we all benefit from people being integrated into society and not removed from it. And so what we found was, people's experiences of being in prison is that they do feel further removed from social supports and society.
Now, you mentioned that the study you did also explores some people's access to their charter rights. And so what are those, and what tactic do you think can be used to try and oppose this legislation because of its violation of charter rights?
Right. So the focus for this report was not so much of a political tool as a call to arms to lawyers. And so we looked and we said, well, this legislation, a lot of people argued against it. All the evidence was heard in front of the committees. They ignored it. The House passed it. And we move on. And so we're looking now, the result is, or the next action is, well, once you have unconstitutional legislation on the books, the action is to go and legally challenge it. And so the report was to lawyers to give them some tools that they could raise or work with social nonprofits or social service organizations to bring these issues out. And so we're concerned about what we found was that this legislation is going to likely affect three charter rights. So the first is cruel and unusual punishment, and so that's Charter Section 12. And so the legislation removes the ability of a judge, by creating a mandatory sentence, it removes the discretion of a judge to look at the circumstances of a particular offender and to craft an appropriate sentence for that offender in the circumstances of the crime. So that's the first leg. The second is Charter Section 7, which is the right to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right to not be deprived of these unless it's done in accordance with principles of fundamental justice. And so we found that, well, with marginalized people who have drug dependence, which is a recognized physical disability, when you incarcerate them, you put their life in danger, you increase their risk of deadly disease, you take away their liberty without proper accommodation for their physical disability and their circumstances. And then the third is the equality provision, Section 15. So we were concerned, again, about the treatment of drug dependency as a physical disability, and it's being treated differently than physical disabilities like diabetes or mental health or any other kinds of things that we may have in society. But also we have to recognize the fact that a vast majority of the people we incarcerate are First Nations. And so we had six of our 19 interviews were people who self-identified as Aboriginal. And it reflects the population that are incarcerated reflect people who are of Aboriginal descent, have disproportionately mental health issues or low income, and are not a cross-section of the population by any means. So those people are unequally affected by this legislation and caught up in it. So those are the three charter rights that we think are most likely going to be affected by this. And again, we're interested in partnering or working with lawyers to raise these issues and bring these issues before the courts.
Well, good luck with that effort.
Thank you.
And thanks for the research.
You're welcome. And I just want to let people know that this report, it's free and available online. You can get it from our website, pivotlegal.org, under publications, and you can download the report. And there's an executive summary you can read to kind of summarize some of the findings that I talked about.
That would be very useful.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Scott Bernstein. He's a lawyer with Pivot Legal and co-author of the report, Throwing Away the Keys. And as he said, it's available on their website at pivotlegal.org.